Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Action Filmmaking Podcast, the podcast dedicated to breaking down action films of all types. My name is Darren Tun, and with me is my amazing co-host, Mike Messina. Today, we have a very special guest, Michael Lear. He has an extensive filmography, including stunt coordination and a lot of shorts, video game mocap, the John Wick franchise, and now Extraction. Michael, it's actually a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me, man. Super fun.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of stuff we're excited to ask you about. And before we jump into that, actually, I wanted to ask, so we were looking around the internet, we found one picture in particular of you getting kicked in the groin by one Kevin Licata. I was wondering, what's your most memorable injury you've gotten on a set?
Oh, man. I mean, that one's pretty hysterical. Like, I think I put that as like my cover photo for my Facebook a few days ago. Yeah, it was always killing me. I think it's one of my.
Oh, best. Really?
Actually, I was just talking to my roommate briefly about this. Maybe the most memorable injury that I got on a set was I was working on this movie called The Vatican Tapes back in 2013. It's like a sort of indie horror film, and the there was like a mishap, like a fluke with a wire rig. I was actually underneath the guy doing a stunt. Like, I'm supposed to slide through these chairs that this guy is standing on top of. It's like in a mental institution sort of thing. He's the guy that I'm kicking the chairs out from underneath is sort of tying his own neck up with the security camera line. And so that's what happens. He falls out from underneath the chairs or whatever and snaps his neck. But the wire rig didn't hold or some fluke, and he fell and landed on my arm and snapped the radius in my left arm, as well as all my wrist ligaments vanished. Apparently, that was actually my my first SAG feature job ever.
And, oh my goodness!
It was a weird sign for me where I was like, man, maybe I'm just not supposed to be in Hollywood. Maybe I'm not supposed to be in like stunts. And I was just sitting there looking at my arm flopping awkwardly. It's like if you look at your hand and hold it out, and then just imagine that your hand is tilted the wrong way, and then just its default position. I was like, something's weird.
So it's just ragdolled.
Yeah, it was very weird. Like I could tell immediately that it was broken. I heard the snap when he landed on me. I even looked him in the eye.
Damn.
I was like, are you okay? Are you okay? And he was kind of like shook up. You know, he hadn't really done a whole lot of stunts, I don't think. I think he was just really an actor or something. And he looked at me and said, like, yeah, I'm fine. Are you okay? And I was like, no, my arm's broke. I'm going to lift your leg off really slowly here so I can pull my broken arm out. And I was just very calm about it. But when I pulled his leg off, I definitely looked at my hand. I was like, yeah, that's not right. That's very terrifying. The moral question, it was worse than anything, because, yeah, it just felt like the world was giving me a sign of like, hey, you shouldn't be in the industry. You should just go back and do whatever. Run a martial arts school. I don't know. Something different than this.
Wow. And so have you ever broken any bone before that? So like, was this kind of like reminding you of those kinds of experiences or?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'd broken a bunch of bones before. Like I think once I hadn't broken a single bone until I started training martial arts when I was like 16. And then it seemed like I'd break a bone every other like week. I think I was just like really fragile. Should have drank more milk. I don't know.
Wow.
but yeah, definitely had a couple of broken ankles, things like that. Had a few broken wrists, broken hands. You know, just happens when you punch and kick stuff, and people like to elbow you when you're trying to throw something. It happens all the time. Taekwondo's like, you throw a roundhouse kick at someone, and they just cover their body with their elbow. You just take an elbow to be in step. And you're like, why? Why is that how we do things?
Right. But yeah, we actually really wanted to jump into your experience with theater next, actually. I know on the radio show, you actually talked about this play, A Thousand Clowns, and that's kind of inspired you to get into acting. Would you be able to explain a little bit more about that experience, watching that play and how that impacted you, and also how theater probably impacted your action career?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think I might have been like 11 years old at that time. I was, my family, we're a military family at the time, so we're living on a place called Wright-Patterson Air Force Base out in Ohio, a little town called Fairborn. And one of my buddies, you know, like I'd moved from all the way from California out to the Midwest, and you know, at the age of 11, you're sort of going through that phase of like, I don't know anybody. It's like that weird time when all the other kids seem to know each other, and then they've had a history. You know, they've known each other since they were like in kindergarten or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't know anyone. The only other guy that didn't really know anybody was, you know, my good friend Lee, who lived
just around the corner. He was another military kid. And so we'd hang out all the time, and he was into theater. He did community theater. So when he invited me out to this play, I was like, oh, okay, cool. I've heard of plays. And I went to it, and it just blew my mind, because, you spend all your days hanging out with someone else, like playing video games and just chilling and eating sandwiches, whatever. And, you just little nerd kids. And then you go to this theater where all of a sudden he's playing a different person, and this whole world comes alive. And it's a very dramatic, it's like a serial comic kind of play, like where it's very funny, but it's also about, child welfare and good parenting and, the relationship between this father who can't provide for his son and the son who doesn't want to be torn from his father, even though the state sort of says this should be the way it goes. It's like he's not being given a good life, but the son's like, no, but I want to stay with the person I care about. And that was his role. He played the son. I just remember at the end of it, when they're trying to tear him away from his father, if I could be completely misrepresenting the play, I feel like I remember it correctly, but the climax of it is just so heartbreaking, and it brought me to tears. And I was like, how is this happening? Also, I'm an 11-year-old boy. I don't cry. No one ever sees me cry. Crying's not a thing. That's for, wimpy kids or whatever. And I was just bawling in this theater in front of a bunch of strangers, with my friend on stage. And I just asked him afterwards, I was like, how did you do that? And he's like, do what? How did you bring that stuff out of me? And I know it's fake. That was the thing that blew my mind. I'm in a theater looking at this stage with a bunch of lights around me. I paid a ticket. It is 100% obviously fake. And the emotions were 100% real, though. So I was like, that's powerful. Mm-hmm. That's really powerful. I'm really impressed. I got a lot of respect for him from that. So I thought that was impressive as all get out. But yeah, that sort of led me down the path of maybe I want to do this. Maybe I want to, you always have fun playing make-believe and whatever. Telling stories is always fun. But to be able to do it in such a poignant way, I just wanted to try my hand at it. So, throughout high school, I joined into the drama club and everything, and started shooting my own little indie films and writing my own little indie scripts, and eventually went to theater in college and decided that's what I wanted to try and do. Wanted to make a run at being an actor. So that's how that whole thing started. And it's been a crazy, crazy road since, because the acting, I think, is something that, back in the day, I feel like, especially when I came to Los Angeles in 2007, people were still of the mindset that stunts and acting don't mix. If you're a stuntman, you should not be an actor. And if you're an actor, don't go around telling people you do stunts. It just makes you look like you don't really know what you want to do. And you don't really, oh yeah, I can do everything. It's clearly no one can just do everything. Nowadays, I think the tenor of that has changed a little bit, where you sort of expect stunt performers to be able to act a little bit. It's like you're a performer, you should be able to perform. And then
because a lot of it is acting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then if there's a lot of actors now, I think especially post John Wick era, where if you can see an actor doing a lot of their own stunts, we sort of want to see it. We want to see an actor actually being capable of a lot of stuff that you wouldn't normally be able to expect from an actor in the past. And
multi-talent.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always more exciting to the audiences, because I think in the YouTube generation, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's almost like we feel that the line between audiences and the productions or whatever is a little bit blurred. We have so much behind the scenes access. Everyone can kind of make a vlog or make a movie themselves, and the resources are there to do it easily, so that I think people feel like they have a big handle on what it's like to make a movie. So if they see a stunt double, they're like, I caught that. That's a stunt double. That's not impressive anymore.
Yeah. I know my mom always points out stunt doubles in films, and she's like, oh, that was a stunt double. So you're completely right about that.
Yeah. But yeah, then after I went to college for theater and got my degree in that, I'd sort of been doing, I did an internship at the Ensemble Theater of Cincinnati, and they taught me a whole lot of stuff too. And it was actually the artistic director of that place, of ETC, a woman named D. Lynn Myers, who persuaded me to go back out to the West Coast. She's like, that's sort of your home, and that's, you're young, you still have all this energy and raw potential. Just go out there and check it out. And if that doesn't work for you, school, continued education will always be there. New York will always be there if you get older and you want to try the theater scene again, but you should go out there for the time being and just give it a shot. And, I was like, well, yeah, SoCal's my home. I'll go back there. I checked it out. Lo and behold, while I've been here, I've transitioned over to the stunt world almost entirely. So I think everything turned out pretty cool from that.
Yeah. So you also mentioned your first mentor, Brian McKnight, in theater. And we were kind of wondering what kind of impact did he have on you as a performer?
Yeah, yeah. I should clarify too. I feel like I never do this, but it's not Brian McKnight the musician. It's even though he is a musician, he's not
okay.
He's not the one that everyone used to always like assume when I said Brian McKnight, be like, what, like the like a singer? I was like, oh, I mean, he like plays the guitar and he sings, but he's not like that guy. But whatever,
he's not that guy.
Yeah. No, Brian is incredibly influential on me. I always considered him my mentor as far as acting goes, because he was maybe the person who's most strongly kind of called me out on my lack of skill. I would say it's not that he was cruel. He was very upfront, and he just knew me very well. Like if I was, I don't know how much you guys are into like theater and acting and stuff, but if I was not playing a strong objective, or if I felt like, you know, oh, my tactics didn't switch at the right time, like that beat change was a little off, he'd call it out. He'd be like, you got in your head, you bailed on it. I could see you thinking about something else. And then, you know, I'd be like, oh, well, I was trying this. And he'd be like, don't give me that. You absolutely are trying to lie your way out of it. No, this is what happened. You know, he's like, oh, my gosh. He just knows. He just knows what's in my brain all the time. It's freaky. It's very freaky.
Yeah. So what does he think about you doing stunts and fights now?
I haven't really asked him that question directly. I'm assuming he thinks it's fine. he's always been incredibly supportive of me no matter what. And I think he's just happy that, you know, any of his students can, you know, kind of continue to follow their passions is, you know, something that not everyone else gets to do. So, he's still acting. He still directs and stuff. He's in Chicago now. And, you know, just I remember working with him when he was directing me, and I thought he was fantastic. So I'm very happy that he's still part of the theater community, because if he wasn't, they would be missing out tremendously from that.
Definitely.
Have you ever done anything on stage that's either stunt or stunt adjacent?
It's strange because, like, even before I was quote unquote into stunts, I was always sort of a physical performer. You know, I went and got certified from like the Society of the American Fight Directors, you know, the SAFD, which is like essentially a safety regulations kind of board for how to do like combat on the stage. And in theater, like I think I did an outdoor drama called Blue Jacket back in 2006. And that was like just a gigantic outdoor drama show. Like we were riding horses, there's like flaming arrows and hatchets. And I was like, I was not the best horse guy. I was not the best archer, but I could definitely throw like a few crazy flips. So they had a few sections that where I'd come out and do like a fight scene and like wielding like dual tomahawks or something. I'm like flipping over a guy in a loincloth that's not really hanging on that well. I'm like, there's a lot of things that could go wrong here, but also I'm not sure that I'm representing like the Native Americans the best way, like doing a bunch of like kung fu in this thing. But you know, we tried to make it as I guess not inauthentic as possible, if that makes any sense, but you know, still have some kind of big high flying cool moments to kind of keep the audiences hooked.
Yeah,
I've done a lot of like shows where, you know, and I think Brian even told me this, he was like, back in the day they would have had an actor in like a company that literally was just the combatant guy, and you know, he'd be a decent actor, but he'd do all of the fights. Like he'd be Laertes in Hamlet, or he'd be Richmond and Richard III, which is the role I actually got to play. And, you know, so there's always going to be those spots on stage where they need a guy who's very physical and do a lot of that stuff. And it seemed like I just sort of gravitated toward those early on, even in the theater world, still sort of hanging close to stunts. So yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a lot of that stuff in there.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Awesome. And actually looking at your whole theater background, so I also did theater in high school. It's something that I sort of latched onto. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
We also had some other similarities, both named Mike, of course.
It's perfect.
both love, of course, you know, action films and also doing martial arts and things like that. And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe we also might both be Asian American adoptees. Does that sound right?
Yeah, absolutely. Where are you from originally?
I'm Korean.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Okay.
Are both your parents American or?
Yes.
Yeah, same here.
I was actually wondering just what that experience was like growing up Asian American and an Asian American adoptee.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because like I also feel like this is such a very specific, it's very prescient to like the times, you know, I guess if that makes any sense. Like when I was adopted, I mean, I was adopted very, very young. I was like 9 months old. So it's like 1984 still when I'm put out into America. And at that time, I really had not even started speaking any Korean or anything like that. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm basically just an American, you know. And both my parents were Caucasian. They're from the Midwest. They're from Illinois, a small town in Illinois called Belleville. And they pretty much just raised me as if they, you know, I was just like a little Midwestern kid. So I didn't really encounter anything weird until, you know, when I was in Southern California growing up early, especially being a military kid, you're meeting a lot of people who are, you know, multicultural, multi-ethnic, you know, a lot of families there were also multi-ethnic as well. Not necessarily, you know, having adopted kids, but just, you know, you'd have a lot of Hapas and stuff. And, you know, like most of my best friends were, you know, they were either Hispanic, you know, African-American, you know, or white. Like they, you know, we all didn't really see it that much at the time, you know. It's a very mixed culture in general down in Southern California, you know, it's close to the Mexican border and everything. And I didn't really notice anything weird, you know, until, because my parents were upfront about it. They were like, oh yeah, you're adopted. And I was like, okay, fine. I don't know what that means. Can I have more candy? And then when we, you know, when we moved to Ohio and I was in the Midwest and became legit a minority, that's when I noticed a lot of, you know, what it, I guess, would mean to be a minority. And that's when it would start to affect me a little bit where, you know, I say this every now and then, this might get too off topic, but, you know, so stop me if I'm going and, you know, randomly into a tangent. But back in college, especially, I used to sort of research this as far as, you know, something like the perpetual foreigner syndrome in coupling with like the model minority. So like, you know, you would be, you know, I would be someone who could only speak English. You know, it's like the only thing I ever learned to speak was English. And I'd be in, you know, a state where a lot of the people were assuming, their first assumption was like, wow, that's weird that you can speak such good English. And I'd be like, I don't understand how that's a thing that's surprising to you. You know, like a lot of other, you know, people would do things like they would demonstrate stuff that they were saying with their hands. I you know, and it's not like they were being mean. Sometimes it was obviously, but you know, people would motion to their mouth. Hey, do you want something to drink? They'd mime a glass. And I'm like, I know what a glass of water looks like. Yeah, I'll have like a Diet Coke if I can, you know, whatever. And then they'd be like, oh, okay. You know, a lot of times they're like, oh, I'm so sorry, whatever. You know, but you get the question a lot of times of, you know, like, oh, where are you from? You know, like, oh, I'm from Oceanside, California, originally. They're like, yeah, but where are you really from?
Where are you really from? Yeah.
That's where I'm really from. Like, I don't know what to tell you, man. You know, it's like, what's your name? And you'll tell them, it's like Michael. And they're all like, oh, well, what's your real name? Like, that's what's on my driver's ID. That's what's on my birth certificate, or not my birth certificate, my adoption certificate. I don't know. Like, what do you want from me? It's like my passport has that, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of dating I know was kind of weird because then, you know, people, at least in some like limited regard, you know, I won't, not saying that like any of like the people I was with, but like, you know, every now and then you'll get someone who is like, oh yeah, like, you know, I heard Asian people are like, you're really honorable, you know? And you're like, I mean, I'm kind of a jerk half the time. I don't know what to tell you. It's like, can you do this math problem for me? I absolutely have no idea how to do that math problem for you. Maybe just find a smart person and not just like a dumb guy who just happens to be Asian. It's like, I don't know. you know, I guess that was maybe the biggest takeaway from it is that being adopted, you sort of don't fit into a lot of social circles, right? It's like, you know, you'll be looked at as a perpetual foreigner by a lot of people, you know, as an Asian American, but then, you know, other Asians will be like, yeah, you're not really Asian either. You know, it's like, you know, my girlfriend right now, like loves to joke about it. Cause she's, you know, she's Korean and she's, you know, from a Korean family and she'll, you know, she's like trilingual. She actually probably speaks better at every language than I do, but, will jokingly call me a Twinkie or a banana. It's, oh, you're yellow on the outside, you're white on the inside. And it's like, that's like an incredibly, you know, probably not a cool thing to say even on this podcast, but like the, but you know, that's sort of the old joke about it. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right about that. Like,
Yeah, I can definitely relate to a lot of that. To the banana thing, the Twinkie thing, or sometimes people hearing your name first and not realizing that you're going to walk in and be this Asian American guy as opposed to whatever else.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. That shock of like, wait, what? And they look at your name twice, like they look down at the papers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, double takes. I don't know.
Yeah. I was wondering if you saw any sorts of like changes in Hollywood in terms of seeing more Asian representation, or especially in the stunt world, if there is a growing sense of Asian Americans in the industry.
Yeah, like I would say definitely. And I think that's just a progression of the times. You know, I think it happens with every ethnic group, especially in Hollywood, because, you know, we are a melting pot. You know, that's what makes us really cool and really great. You know, we see all these different things, you know. And so like, for me specifically, for example, like I wouldn't have even started martial arts back when I was 16 if I hadn't decided that I wanted to be an actor to begin with, because in like 1998, like 99, like when I was sort of mulling around the idea, I was saying to myself, you know, if I am ever going to see an Asian actor on camera, like on TV or film or whatever, they're always doing punches and kicks. It's like, well, I guess you got to be like a Jet Li or a Jackie Chan or a Donnie Yen. It's like, there's no, or like, you know, Bruce Lee. It's like, I didn't really know many actors, like, you know, there's guys like BD Wong and stuff, you know, who are just, you only really see them being great actors, you know, and they're actors, you know, but the, you know, in my mind, I was like, oh, I guess I got to learn how to do some flips and kick really high and do all that stuff. So I just, you know, turned to martial arts essentially to support my acting. The strange thing now is that, you know, since moving to Los Angeles and like especially in the last, like, you know, 7 or 8 years or so, I think it's kind of gone out of favor of like, a good example being I auditioned for something once where they were asking me to do like an accent, a Konglish, like fob accent. And I, fresh off the boat, if people don't know what that means on the listeners or whatever. But you know, and I had this reticence of it because, look, when I was in theater, I learned how to do like British, Scottish, Irish, you know, it's like all the standard, like, you know, accents that you would learn in a school setting. You know, I never learned how to do an Asian dialect. And so when they asked me to do it, it felt very weird. Again, my parents aren't Asian. I've never heard what that really sounds like. I kind of have heard it, but I, you know, mostly from other movies and TVs and stuff. So, you know, I was like, I guess I'll try to do it. And I didn't do it very well. Obviously, I didn't get cast at all. It was a horrible audition because I was just not in my element. You know, it's out of my head at that point in time. And the impact of that was very strange. People were, you know, even asked me later on when I told them about it, they're like, oh man, they asked you to do like an OG Asian accent. I was like, yeah. And they're like, oh, that's not cool. Like, oh, why? You know, and people sort of explain it now. It's like, well, that idea of like, I can't just be an Asian person and have a regular American accent. Like I have to have this dialect now as like an issue. So sometimes now even doing like martial arts, oh, you're like an Asian karate master. Oh, what a stereotype, you know? And so it's like, I feel like we don't even want necessarily those things because we're so careful about this might say the wrong thing about what we're trying to show in the show. You know, take a show like Cobra Kai, for example, right? Which is essentially, it's about karate, you know, or karate, I'm terrible. But it's like, you know, and look at the cast, even look at the main student, you know, it's like, it's right, an Hispanic kid, right? Like it's not, we're not filling that whole show with a bunch of Asian people. In fact, I think there might be only like one or two Asian people in the entire, like, you know, first or second season. I can't, you know, that's, I haven't watched all of it, but it's like, that's a show that's about martial arts where we don't want to just see a bunch of stereotypes running around doing martial arts. And I think that's something to be applauded, but I think that's not necessarily, like just an odd thing. I think that's like a symptom of the progression that we find ourselves in, if that makes any sense. I think that we don't want to reinforce stereotypes as much as we can. You know, I think we want to try and find what seems more natural and more of a reflection of the real world, you know? So we're holding the mirror up to nature, as we say, right? So it's even in our media, when we're dealing with something like stereotypes, I think we're all trying to be very cautious and careful to not misrepresent things, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a tricky line to be balancing on. I know there's this Disney Channel show from a couple of years ago called Kickin' It about karate. And I wasn't sure if it would be worse if it were no Asians on it or if it were all Asians. But like you're saying, it's a tricky thing to balance. But I know you are also in Mulan, which is coming out at some point soon, I hope. That seems to be something where it just makes a lot of sense to have a pretty much all Asian or Asian American cast.
Yeah, definitely. And that was, you know, it's a period piece too, essentially, you know, and a remake of like a Disney property. I was, to be fair, I was only part of the reshoots that were happening here in Los Angeles. So I got to double the lead guy for like 3 weeks. But for, it was really just for like one major sequence. And then, we did a bunch of like filler stuff for a few other sequences. But I wasn't the guy that carried through the entire show on that thing. Obviously, like the crew that went out to New Zealand and all those, those guys deserve a ton of credit. I don't want to step on their toes and say that I did any of their work for them. I was just part of the reshoots, even though those were fantastic. We had an amazing team there. But the whole cast, all of them, I don't think any of them had like weird dialects or anything. They were all very much well-spoken, like English speaking, just Asian people, I don't know if they're all Asian Americans, but it was, I think that movie's a good sign of the times too, where I don't think we want to see necessarily, I think it's at that point where we can see someone doing maybe English accent, like an American standard dialect as an Asian person, even in a period piece, and not be like, oh, that's weird. I think that's okay nowadays, that we don't have to like subtitle or whatever, or do, like give them a weird accent. Like, I think I would bemoan that movie if they forced everyone to have like weird stilted accents and stuff, which I think, I've seen in the past from like other movies and everything. And so, it's good to see that we're moving in that way, like as a progressive world.
And on the topic of language or accents and dialects, I feel like stunts and action is one dialect or language that everyone sort of speaks. Was there anything in particular that you did on Mulan or in Mulan that you're really excited for people to see?
It's so funny. I feel like there's a couple of things that if people do catch it, it's probably because they shouldn't be catching it. Like, okay, I'll tell you guys, this is like a little weird insider thing, but like, so one of the things that we do, and this is kind of standard on like a movie where you have like a big war scene, you'll have to kind of do these plates, right? Of like, you'll have like 10 or 20, like stunt people just in a group. And then you'll have a bunch of like, background maybe behind them. And then, you'll kind of move these people into different spots and just you'll copy and paste them, VFX wise throughout the field, make it look like there's just thousands of people going to war.
Bigger crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, you're kind of trying to make up little things here and there, and like, okay, we'll change it. Maybe like two or three beats of the choreography, I'll change it here. It's like, okay, I'll go this direction instead of that direction. But you're moving pretty quick because you want to get this stuff all done really fast. And on one of the days, I think I was just starting to, I think we were just running out of ideas, and someone said, "Oh yeah, like I'll kill you first, and then I'll come over here." And I was like, "Wait, what?" And I was like, what's happening? And he's all like, all right, ready? And then they're like, action. And I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to just go along with this. And then I just faked him out. And I like dropped my weapon. I grabbed his. I like hip threw him. And like I'm a jiu-jitsu guy too. So I did like a little Ogoshi hip throw. And like stripped his weapon and like pulled an arm bar on him. We're supposed to be like sort of like ancient like Chinese warriors. I'm just doing full-on Brazilian jiu-jitsu to a man in armor. And he's a good buddy of mine. He's laughing the entire time. We're just like dying. And we're like, is anyone even going to see this? It's like, if anyone does see this, it's probably not a good thing, but that's what happens when you start trying to make up choreography, like in the last possible seconds, it's like, go.
And the director didn't catch any of it.
No, I'm sure they were just totally fine with whatever we were doing. Because again, we're gonna be such small pixels somewhere, like in the very, very deep background. Or, they'll probably look at it and be all like, hey, isn't that the guy that doubled what's his name? Maybe just cut him out of this fight scene. He looks weird there. In the actual sequence that I had to, double the actor Yosun on for, I got to be fair, he was so capable of doing his own action that I think I did it just as a formality for a few spots. Mm-hmm. There were some things that, we were like, oh, maybe he won't feel as comfortable doing this. And then we test him out and he's fantastic. I mean, wow. He just nailed everything. He was a black belt himself in martial arts. So he's just very, very physical and, very, very nice, very chill guy. I tried to do whatever I could for him whenever I was needed, but honestly, I think the director really liked the fact that he could do so much of his own action because he did quite a lot of it. Him and the lead actress, Ife, she was fantastic. They are very, very capable performers as well as actors.
That's amazing to hear. Just like that those actors were like capable of doing so much, even not being stunt crew, I guess. That's great.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And of course that speaks to like the training that they did in, overseas with the original stunt team. They must've got them into really, really great shape. Obviously, I think a lot of times you know, those performers came in with a really good skill set, and then that Sun team took them to a new level of expertise. And, you know, we sort of got the chance to hang out with them after that. And I was like, oh, this is easy. It's like someone already did all the work for us, because these actors are just fantastic. We're just walking through the paces, but they're already really good.
Wow. Well, speaking of new films that are coming out, I saw that you were coordinator on Fast 9, but I was just wondering, what was it like to work with a director like Justin Lin?
Justin Lin is fantastic. I mean, obviously, you know, he's been making these movies for a long time. He's made some of the greatest movies that we've ever, you know, seen, especially like, you know, if you're, you know, an Asian American and stuff, like he's a standout, you know, for the movie that launched him, you know, essentially. And at least that's what I know him for mainly. But then his ability to juggle such a big set, that's what blows my mind. I think a lot of times we get lost in what a good director is. And this is not to take away from like other directors and things, but and I hope this doesn't come off the wrong way, but I feel like some directors, when we talk about them, if they're a good director, it's because they've made a very thought-provoking, very intelligent piece. You know, someone like, if you look at something like Memento by Christopher Nolan, right? Amazing movie, amazing directing. Like, that is a fantastic, it's a masterpiece.
Incredible.
Right? And at the same time, I think we can lose the sight of what it means to be a director of something like a Fast 9, which is you have to juggle so many components and make it still, it still has to be heartfelt, still has to be emotional. Yeah. And that movie is, there's, you know, I can't give too much away, but it's crazy. Look at any of the Fast and Furious movies. They're so big. They're so incredible. That to me is, that's like making a Star Wars. That's like making a Lord of the Rings. There's so many pieces and components that go into it that you still have to, it's a, it's an immense juggling act. And he was always 100% very clear in his thought process. Like, his vision seemed very clear. You know, we would give him like a, I'd shoot a pre-visualization. We'd ask him for notes, and his notes were so succinct. Like, they're very specific, and you know, they would often point us in directions that would, if we were like kind of stumped, it would point us in the right direction to make it very easy. And you know, he was always very clear and very upfront about that too. And on top of that, you know, he's not like a mean person. He's a very, very nice, you know, he gave us a lot of his time. He was very, very good listener, very thoughtful. Yeah, I mean, he's a pleasure to work with. You know, it's, he's one of those guys, when you're working with him, you're just hoping that you're doing the right thing for him the entire time. I'm like, I really hope that I'm able to impress this guy, because you know, clearly he knows what he's doing, and you know, you don't want to fall behind him on a movie like that.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. So he gave you like a lot of, I guess, leeway when it came to coordination, I'm assuming, freedom wise.
I mean, with from my perspective as like the fight coordinator, there's a bit of a hierarchy where I'm, you know, I'm kind of answering up a long chain of things. But in the times that I had to go to Justin Lin to personally ask for notes, because, you know, you get busy, people are in different directions, and they're like, hey, can you go up to Justin, ask him for these notes, like, or let's try and figure out this thing that leads up to something later on, or what have you. He was always very, very good at just telling us exactly what he needed and what he was looking for, to the point where, you know, you don't want to come back and ask him like 9 more times the same question, you know what I mean? Because he's giving such a clean answer the first time that, you know, it makes your job much easier. So I would say that, yeah, he did give us definitely like sort of free rein, but he also had a clear vision. So, you know, that's the collaborative aspect of film, right? He's giving us, he's trusting us to do our jobs. And then, you know, as we're doing our jobs, he's sort of like pushing and pulling us to make sure that we're doing it in the right direction that, you know, is in accordance with the vision.
Guidance.
Yeah. And that's, again, that is part of the juggling act of being an amazing director, in my opinion, you know, where he's not micromanaging. He's letting us do what we have to do, and like let us, our department, do what, you know, our department has to do, in order to make his vision come true, which is incredibly difficult, because, you know, I've directed a few like short films and stuff myself, and the hardest part for me was like learning how to do bigger and bigger things, was letting go of my control on things, you know, trusting that, you know, hey, you wrote and you directed this thing, but like, hey, this actor is going to have this completely different vision. Maybe let him run with it. He's the actor. He's the one whose job it is to embrace his character. You know, you have to step back as like maybe a writer director sometimes and just let this person run with it. And that especially goes for like, you know, something like stunts. You know, it's like, if you're making a whole big action scene and there's like a little bit of a fight in there, it's, you know, telling your fight coordinator, this is the context in which it happens. I'm trusting you to go not mess up the context, you know, and letting it happen. And sometimes that'll take a few redirects, but ultimately, you know, the best kind of director, I think, is the one that will trust you to do your job correctly. You know, they hired you for a reason. You know, it's our job not to disappoint them, not let them down. You know, it's like we will serve their vision, and you know, on their part, it's them trusting us to serve that vision. That's an incredible balancing act.
100%. I think that's kind of similar to like what Sam was saying, that you really never know who's going to have a great idea. So you obviously want to be open to whatever comes your way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very tricky challenge, because you know, in my experience from the small things that I've done, letting go of your creative vision enough to let someone else kind of help shape it it can be such a tense and scary, you know, moment. But, you know, the real veterans, I feel like, yeah, the ones who've done it a million times, they just know how to do it. And
they have faith in it.
Yeah, yeah. It's remarkable.
Yeah, 100%. Another piece of work that you've done that I'm a really big fan of, actually, but I want to hear you give your take on it, is the Migos music video that you were a part of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was it like working with them and, you know, coordinating those fights?
That was super fun. I kind of got that one off of like on a whim, like the coordinator who was running it, Vince Capone, he sort of hit me out of the blue. Like I'd never worked with him before. But yeah, he had talked to me about, he just hit me up and like asked me to come talk to him about this music video thing. And yeah, like eventually, you know, he was out in LA, wow, we were shooting it. It literally was maybe about a half a mile down the street from my apartment. It's next to a famous stunt gym. It's in this restaurant, I believe it's called The Great Wall. It's the restaurant, they shot the ending of Drive in it. Cause when I walked in, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in the restaurant that, you know, they did Drive in, and I'd never been in there in like the years that I lived next to it. Yeah, it was amazing.
Idea.
I was like, oh
wow,
my God, this is so cool. Like Ryan Gosling was like right here. But the, that we did it overnight. That was like a thing, yeah, where, you know, obviously the restaurant during non-operational hours when we were allowed to shoot there, and, you know, got to bring in a few of my buddies. We did like a little previs for it. You know, everyone thought it was like super cool. I was amazed at how much fight choreography they wanted. Cause I'm like, I listened to the song. I was like, nice, you know, I'm a fan. It's like, it, you know, I like Migos and stuff. Like,
wow,
the it's definitely not like, yeah, more than 5 minutes. So like, how are we choreographing? Like, when your previs is almost longer than the song, you're like, at what point do we see them? Like, at what point do we get to see them like rapping? Like, it's kind of crazy.
In the music video itself.
but yeah, it was a long yeah, night where, you know, obviously what happens in a lot of these things is like, you know, you'll choreograph something. This is my fault too, as a fight coordinator back in the day. It's like I choreographed a little too much, you know, in that sense, I was like, well, we tell the story, but I'm always going to leave a few things that we can cut out, because I just know that on the day we're going to have to cut something. But you know, you don't want to give them like too little, you know, so you give them a little bit, and then, or you give them a decent size fight, knowing that you're going to be able to extract some sequences from it. We did end up with some delays, and there was sort of like a thing where we had to shoot as much of the, I guess, what would be second unit, even though there wasn't really a second unit, but, you know, just like doing all the doubles coverage, like super, super quick up front. And then when we were able to get into it, you know, it was kind of amazing how much, like, Quavo especially like did a lot, yeah, of his choreography, which was wild. It was like he, you know, they had to do like a lot of close-ups. I don't know how much of it they used. Obviously like a lot of the big, like crazy, wow, stuff. That's like his, you know, that's his, doubles, my friend Guy De Silva, who's like an amazing performer. So, you know, when you get out to the wides, you can see all these, you know, you can't even see like a flip or something like that if it's too close, you know? So a lot of it, they, you know, they just went to do the big wrecks. They're just using the wide footage anyway. I haven't seen that music video in a while, but I remember, like the main thing that someone took away from it was how much like I looked like I had like a scar, like I had a scar on my face, and they were like, man, it's weird. You sort of look like Mads Mikkelsen from like Casino Royale. And like, I'm pretty certain that I saw the picture,
yeah,
of him
did, yeah,
on the, in the makeup trailer, that was the makeup they were kind of like going for, that same look. And it was like, they wanted that.
Oh,
yeah. Sort of like at least inspired. It's like that cold, steely, like, this guy's quiet because he's probably seen a bunch of violence already. And he just like doesn't talk much. Like, yeah, it's kind of crazy. But it's, yeah, that was such a, you know, fun music video, because it's clearly,
wow,
spoofing, not spoofing, but it's like an homage to like, you know, 70s like Kung Fu, you know, the way it crash zooms, the color, the grain on it and stuff. I thought that was super cool. Like the director, I believe his name is Sing J. Lee. Mm-hmm. I thought the whole look of that music video was so, so awesome, you know? And obviously that's a world that I
came up. Aesthetic was great.
Yeah. I sort of grew up watching a lot of those movies too and stuff, especially early in my like kind of acting stunt, you know, messing around days. You're getting to perform in something that you know, it's something that's an homage to something that you, you know, you grew up on, and you're like, this is dope. I get to perform as like an old 70s Kung Fu villain. Man, that's like, I would pay someone else for the opportunity to do this. So that's,
you were like the main boss too.
Yeah, I originally think I had pitched a few guys to come in and play that role, and then I think just from budget constraints, they were like, well, you know, we just won't be able to have this day of like rehearsal, something like that. I can't even remember exactly, but it was maybe we were like short on money or time or what have you. But it ended up being me stepping into the role, and you know, I was like, fine, I guess. But you know, I was just assuming it was going to be really tiring, and it was.
It looked like a lot of fun, though.
Oh, it was super cool. I think there's a shot where like I'm having to crush like a little takeout container with my hand that they like
do a little crash.
And I just remember, like, if you're seeing the insert of the hand crushing it, like, then it's like I'm trying not to laugh hysterically the entire time. I thought it was, and not
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, not because I thought it was dumb, but it's because I was like giddy. I was like, "This is so cool! I'm nerding out so much on it. Like, I get to crush, like, break this cardboard
takeout."
Yeah, I was like, "All right, I guess that's the legacy that I'm going to leave right now."
Every time I have Chinese food now, that's how I'm going to take out the trash. That's going to be the last thing I do right after I finish. It's going to be great. So we've talked about. Movies, we talked about theater and music videos. I'd love to talk a little bit about video games. I know that it seems like you're a fan of the classics, Mario, Mario Kart, Final Fantasy, stuff like that. Could you talk a little bit
about... Yeah, I'm a huge gamer.
Yeah, it's great. And looking through your catalog of work that you've done, it's crazy how many games that you've done motion capture work for that I personally love, whether it is a Star Wars game or a DC superhero game. Can you talk about like some of the high points or maybe some of the less high points of your motion capture experience?
Yeah, definitely. Like I got my start on mocap when I did this TV show called The Deadliest Warrior on Spike TV. It's like back in 2008.
Love that show.
Oh man, it was amazing. Like it was a very weird roundabout way in which I got to that audition and then ended up getting cast. I couldn't believe it. And but the second unit, director on that, or the stunt coordinator at least on that show, ended up getting me into motion capture like later on that year. And the first thing I did was the UFC, I believe it was 2009, 2008, I can't remember. It was one of the UFC games. It was like the first big one that THQ made. And they were like, oh, you're like, do you do any like grappling or any MMA experiences? Like that is almost exactly what I do. So the jump into that was like my first mocap gig. You know, you're flipping out because it's like, you know, you sort of know the behind the scenes of how mocap goes. And so it seems so exotic and elusive. It's like, this is the part of games that is like filmmaking. And that's a very specialized sort of thing. So when, you know, I was out in there doing mocap stuff as like a UFC fighter, I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. Eventually it led to me getting, I think maybe one of the biggest things that I got to do for them was actually a game called Sleeping Dogs, which hopefully everyone remembers because Sleeping Dogs, I platinumed every DLC on that game. Like I love Sleeping Dogs. And
it's the best.
Yeah, I was back on it when it was a game called True Crime Hong Kong, when Activision was heading it. So we shot for like a year and a half on that thing, I want to say. And like I was playing all these different characters and stuff. I even did some like voice acting for it. And then eventually got sold over to Square Enix, like the IP. And I'm so sad they didn't really do another one, but that was a long experience for me, like a year and a half of knowing the world. And at that point you feel like you're doing a movie, like you're in this big open volume and they're naming a location and you just sort of know what it looks like and what it feels like. You know these characters, and even though everyone's just wearing weird spandex with balls attached to them and some cameras on their faces, you know, you're sort of getting this whole vibe of like a real world and the story of it and the script. And right. So, you know, like I remember there being some very emotional scenes that I got to see, you know, that some of my good friends who are actors were performing. And it just, you know, again, it's sort of like that thing from that community theater, you know, back in the day, you know, when I first got into acting, was I'm watching people covered in little plastic balls with spandex on and big camera rigs attached to their faces. So it's like a bill on a trucker hat. Like you can't get too close to each other or else you like smack each other in the face. And they're having these intimate moments with these weird apparatuses on their head in a cold open volume and a bunch of people standing around. And it's, you know, of course they're doing like T poses beforehand and afterwards. the emotions are 100% real and you feel it in the room. And it felt very much like a little black box theater for me. So mocap for me was very special in that way that, you know, we don't do things in cuts. You do things in scenes. You know, it's like they have to have everything very specifically mapped out so that it all plays out in real time. And that was almost a throwback to theater for me. You're also doing so much imagination work to create the world, even the things that you're holding. You know, we had this joke about how on that game of like, and then an explosion happens, you know, because you would have to do this idle set of motions where like, all right, I'm walking down the street on my cell phone. And it's like, okay, so you're just walking the street talking. And then it's like someone, you see a gun go off. So you're startled. Then you run the other way, you know, and you reset. And then it's like, okay. And then an explosion happens. Because at some point in time, you could be, you know, you're an NPC walking down the street in the Grand Theft Auto game. And the main character decides to throw a bomb at something or shoot a rocket. And then like, you know, you have to be a stand, you know, passersby, like standby kind of person with a bystander with a cell phone that gets jumped into the air and you fall into this big, you know, stunt mat. And I think the best one for me was like at one point there's four of us doing it simultaneously and we're on the toilet. We're like, we're all sitting on toilets and it's like a gunfight breaks out. So you're kind of reacting to a gunfight happening outside, you know, ostensibly with what would be your pants around your ankles. And then of course we all know it's coming like the fourth pass. It's like, okay, so you guys settle. So you're on the toilet, you know, you're just chilling around, you know, and we're just kind of like doing our idols. And then an explosion happens and like we all just like flip off of a toilet, like into a big, you know, like you're trying to do like a big header, like onto a mat in front of you. It's like, if this makes the game, this is crazy. There's some dude with his pants around his ankle is going to go like front flipping out of a bathroom stall from a grenade. I'm like, I can't wait to play this game. That's the first thing I'm going to do when I get the chance to play the game. You know, yeah, I would say like Sleeping Dogs for me is kind of my big one that I remember most fondly, even though I don't think a lot of people will know that. You know, I don't have a lot of footage that I show from it or anything, but that was where I met a lot of the stunt people that I'm now really close friends with today. You know, a lot of those people inspired me to go into stunts instead of acting, you know, is because you spend a year and a half working with all these same people and, you know, you're the ones who are always getting blown out of toilets together. You know, it's like you develop sort of a familial bond, you know?
Yeah. Connection there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and it's strange. I turned away from mocap a little bit sort of in, I think, gosh, it was like 2012. It was before the UFC games changed over to being by EA Sports.
Okay.
And the exact time when it happened was, we had been doing the UFC games, and every year we'd do like an update on it, and I'd come in and do some mocap, and it was pretty chill. And then the last one that I did was just – it was just a little too physically demanding for me. It was just – it involved – they were trying something different with like the mechanics of it. And I just remember I really wrecked myself hard for it. And, you know, at least back in the day, like a lot of those jobs weren't covered by the union. So you're not working for SAG wages. Even though you're getting paid well, it's still like, you know, you're being 1099 at the end of the year. So you have to save that money or else, you know, you're going to get taxed at the end of it. And it's all a whole bunch of stuff that when you're young, you sort of wish you knew and you had a better understanding of. But, you know, at the time, I just sort of showed up, did the work and was like, well, I'll just figure it out later on. And unfortunately, I wrecked my body too much for not enough reward, I guess, on the other end. And that game never even came out. Like when they were trying to do it, there was THQ trying to do a new spin on the game. And unfortunately, it kind of went out of business. And then EA picked it back up and, you know, their whole thing ended up fine. I don't know if my data ended up in that game kind of like the way that, like, you know, Sleeping Dogs used to be True Crime. But, you know, if it's in there, you know, like I'd feel proud of it because I definitely remember getting rocked quite a few times doing the mocap for that show.
Wow. I was really a really big fan of the Star Wars Force Unleashed video game that you did some work for, just like Starkiller and the action sequences in there. I was wondering, what was it like to actually design the action behind the character of Starkiller?
Yeah, so like that one, I played Starkiller for, we were there for the E3 trailer in 2010. And that trailer was like, it was pretty extensive. You know, it's like when he's in the room and Darth Vader comes in and he's like chained to the floor and stuff. And then the opening sequence with the lightsabers, before, you know, where he kills all the troopers in the dark in that trailer, that's all me. And then when he goes out into the hangar and starts going nuts on everybody, that's me and three other stunt guys. And they were all, I would hazard a guess that I think all three of them are better than me by far. And they're all guys that I look up to greatly now. You know, and we had a great, you know, set of coordinators on there and stuff too. Those guys were fantastic. The actual game, I think, had already been made by that point in time. and we were just doing the trailer for it. But that was
the trailer.
It was amazing. It was one of the most cinematic things I'd ever seen, and that's kudos to Blur Studios. I don't know if they're still around, but they should be. But Blur Motion Capture Studios, they were incredible. They made some of the best cinematics, especially for the Star Wars games, Knights of the Old Republic and stuff. Like, a lot of those games back then was just them being really on point with their action. Something like that is a lot of fun because you're trying to engineer a couple of weird like moments in there, right? Like stuff like, I remember at one point I had to land and then pick up an AT-ST and crush it with my hands and throw it into a bunch of other guys. And you're just sort of imagining what that's like. But it's so cool to sit there and be like, you know, because as kids, when you watch Star Wars, you're always walking around swinging sticks and making lightsaber noises and then like pointing your hands at people and acting like you're using the Force, you know, and it's like, yeah, you're just using your little kid. And then all of a sudden that's your job, is to be a little kid and play that. And then they turn it into something very cool and very, you know, you can watch it, like you can watch it on YouTube right now. It's like, that's incredible, you know, but again, that's also four of us trying to play one character. And so they're mixing all these different things in. And that was them taking the sort of like, what are the best parts that these guys can do? And then building a, like crafting a scene out of it, doing an action design on it. I know at one point in time, it's the part where he jumps on top of the walker and he's like stabbing it with his lightsabers, and then the slide down.
Oh yeah.
Sliding down from that, they had to build this gigantic like scaffolding thing that one of the stuntmen literally was on top of and jumped down and slid down and like flipped off of. And, you know, it's crazy because obviously that's a whole CGI thing at the end of it. But on the day, that was really, you know, a friend of mine jumping off a thing, sliding down like a gigantic apparatus and then flipping off of it at the end. And then they turn it into like a big Star Wars scene. That's so cool to me because I feel like, you know, when you're on a film or TV set, it sort of still looks like how it's really going to look, you know. But then when you're doing mocap, you're just in a volume with spandex guys. And so that I...
So you have to imagine.
Yeah, it's so cool. And of course, it's Star Wars. So we're all of us were Star Wars nerds. We all, you know, who doesn't make a lightsaber noise when they pick up a stick and swing it around? You know, it's like everyone does. It was funny because like that trailer dropped. And during the time that dropped, I'd actually gone back to Ohio to do like a martial arts testing thing. And I blew my ACL pretty bad at that time. And so I ended up not working with them for a long, for many more years, you know, just because, you know, they end up having to find people to replace them. And then a new team comes in and, you know, people just move on because, you know, ACL recovery is very, very long. It takes a long time to get through that. But when I was sort of on the recovery from it, that trailer came out and I went to an audition for a commercial, and some of the guys in the room, the waiting room, were talking about the trailer for The Force Unleashed 2. And they made a whole deal about how, like, man, the actor did all of his own stunts and blah, blah, blah. And it was amazing. And, like, look at him doing all these flips. You know, and I tried to correct him and let him know, like, hey, you know, the actor did a lot of stuff, like, on the actual game. But for the trailer, you know, he wasn't there. You know, or he didn't do the stunts for the trailer. He did definitely some acting stuff for it. And he does do fight stuff for the game, but not for that one trailer. And I just remember getting this heated argument with these, like, this one guy in particular who just said that, you know, like, you don't know anything about like how video games are made. You don't know anything about like stunts, like blah, blah, blah. Like, I've seen the behind the scenes. And I was like, I mean, I was there. I didn't have any footage to show him at the time on my phone, you know, like we would now, but it was all like, you know, yeah, I was there, man. Like, and it wasn't necessarily the thing. This is the thing that really upset me, was that, like, you know, it wasn't that I was in an argument with this guy or whatever. It was that I knew that there were other stuntmen in there who were not getting their credit for doing something so amazing, you know, that when people, and this is of course the big debate now about, like, you know, Oscars for the stunts and everything like that. And like how, you know, but any time that I can sit there and say, like, look, this is objectively something that I know the guy who did it and I saw how amazing it was, even though it's a CGI thing, I saw him really flip off a gigantic thing that we had built, you know, that's still amazing to me. And so to hear someone not really, you know, give into that, like, or miscredit that, I was like, well, let me just like at least correct that. You know what I mean? Not to say the actor wasn't amazing. He absolutely was a very physical actor, but, you know, I think he himself was keen on the idea if there's something, you know, like most actors are, this is a big stunt. If it's something that it's going to look better for the character, you know, let the stunt person handle it, you know?
Stand up for stunts. Let's go.
I love it. Age old debate, you know?
So let's see. So going sort of adjacent to video games, I suppose, is animation. So I was wondering if there were any sort of animated fight scenes that you really loved, and if you would ever be interested in doing an animated fight scene of your own.
Oh, man. You know, this is so bizarre because I feel like those are getting more and more of like a, I think back in the day when I was like a younger and I loved anime, right? And I love video games and I love things like that. And people in the day didn't give those things enough credit for being really cinematic, you know, and you'd show them something like a Dragon Ball Z, like where they're like, wait, so they just like use the same three frames of animation for literally 90% of the episode. Like when they're in the sky, I'm like, you got to ignore that. But it's like, but I would show them things like, you know, like look at where the Matrix was influenced by, like look at Ghost in the Shell. And then like, look at something like Ninja Scroll, right? Look at something like Akira, like all these very, very amazing like pieces of action, stuff that you can't do conventionally, but you know, you can do it in animation. And then lo and behold, something like Kenshin comes out, like Rurouni Kenshin, like the live action, you know, and you're just like, all right, guys, the gauntlet's been thrown. Like they figured out how to make anime look like just make it real. Like this is a real life anime fight scene. And it's one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my life. We have to sort of match this point in time. You know, it gets your mind really thinking, you know, you're obviously like informed by all of your inspirations, your influences, you know. For me, I always feel like I would not do the right job, but I would love to take a crack at something like a Ninja Scroll. But you know, if I were to have like one real like weird fantasy, I don't even know if people know about this movie. There's an old animation called Iria, the Zerim animation, which I used to watch on the Sci-Fi Channel and like Saturday Anime as a kid. I recorded it. I bought the DVD as soon as I could. I think that's one of the coolest like animes ever. Have you guys ever heard of that one?
I haven't.
I have not. Yeah.
Oh man, Iria, check it out. The main woman, you know, like Ivy in Soul Calibur, right? She's got like that chain sword thing. Mm-hmm. The first place I ever saw that was in Iria. It's like the story of this, it's like this young bounty hunter. It's like a sci-fi, you know, very like kind of like early 90s, like anime, like sci-fi, you know, but like it's like there's a space monster and stuff. And then she kind of like, you know, it like has to hunt him down across the system, like the planet. It's very, very cool. The soundtrack's amazing. Maybe just go check it out, because maybe I'll go watch it like after I'm done with this podcast. Yeah, it's been a while. But that it's like it's weird because it's almost like a Batman-esque set of action scenes that she gets into. She's using a lot of like gadgets, right? A lot of gadgets, a lot of environmental stuff. And the gadgets are like, they're just so cool because they're science fiction anime gadgets. And I'm like, man, it's like if you could have like a Batman scene, but also he's got like a katana, it's like, this is dope. I don't know who thinks this isn't dope, but it's pretty phenomenal. Yeah, I love that movie. And I think if they ever did, I think it's actually, they did like a live action or something, or they base it off a live action. But that was like back in the 80s, I want to say. And it's time for revival is what I'm saying, and that I would love to do it. And I would probably not do it nearly as well as the people that do get picked to do it if they ever do.
That's actually, wow, that's incredible. I actually wanted to jump into another franchise that you worked on, John Wick 3. The John Wick franchise, but specifically John Wick 3. I know you did a fight scene in that movie with Akira, and I was wondering, what was your experience like filming this scene?
Yeah, so like my story with the John Wick series actually starts quite a bit beforehand. I worked on the second film, and I was one of Keanu's like main training partners, I would say, for the beginning of when we first started prepping him. I mentioned Justin Yu earlier in the podcast. He and another guy, Eric Brown, both good friends of mine, both great, you know, fight stunt coordinators. We'd worked in Bollywood on a film in 2014. That's where I got to know him. And then they had worked extensively on the first John Wick film, which came out while we were in India. So when we came back from India, they were already thinking about doing the second one, or they're starting to go on prep for it. And so during the summer, they called me in to come be one of Keanu's training partners. You know, especially Keanu's really tall, so we just need like kind of taller martial arts guys to come in and do it. You know, I'm like a near 6 foot myself. So yeah, when we were training in there, I think they were trying to find a spot that they could fit me in. We ended up doing a fight scene, Keanu and I, that got cut from the film for various reasons. There's a lot of stuff that got cut from those movies, like lots and lots, especially action stuff, you know, because they're chock full of things. You know, and I never got the chance to see it, but you know, I heard that they replaced it with another scene that I thought was just fantastic. So I have no qualms about it. I still got paid. I still had a great time. And at that point in time, that's when I started really training over at 8711. You know, and taking like Chad Stahelski's class and stuff. He was doing like a training thing for a lot of the people that were going to be involved in it. And that kind of continued all the way through when John Wick 3 was happening, I was actually working on a film, Gemini Man, at the time that they were starting with it, and I couldn't come out to John Wick 3. They wanted me on, I think, to be one of the like nondescript, like kind of core guys, you know, just also be there to help train and do what I'd been doing before. But I was already on another production. Eventually, I ended up getting out there. They were like, hey, we want you to come in and do like a fight sequence. And I thought it was like the same as before, where it was, you're going to show up, you're going to do like maybe, I don't know, you'll be one of like five guys who run in and get shot. And that'll be that. And then I was like, okay, cool. And then I found out that I was going to be one of like Mark Dacascos's henchmen. And I'm like, wait, so how much of this movie are we in? Like, we're just in it like for like one sequence, right? And it turned out to be just a very like, not in a bad way. It was such a gift that it was such, you know, that we were able to do so much work on that film, as like sort of his shinobis and what have you. And I was like, this is cool. Like, we're modern day like ninjas. Like, I love this. This is such a like nerdgasm for me, you know, just being an action film martial arts fan. And it's cool because something like that film, like the John Wick series, it innovated a lot of stuff, right? It's like 2014 when it came out, it changed the way we look at action. We're living in the John Wick era right now as far as what we expect from actors to be able to perform. You know, we expect a lot out of like the gun work, you know, we expect a lot out of like the martial arts. Like, you saw a huge explosion of like judo and jiu-jitsu techniques in movies afterwards, you know, as a result of John Wick. You know, I firmly believe that. The same way that The Matrix caused bullet time to appear, the same way that, you know, after Ong Bak, we all wanted to do like a bunch of like really brutal stunts, the same way that Bourne Identity made everything, you know, like a Kali fest with like some shaky cameras and stuff, you know. But like, yeah, as much as people will complain about the shaky cam for something like that, there are a lot of really great innovations that those movies all gave us. And we lived in their eras for a short time afterwards. And right now, that's what the John Wick series has done for us. So something like John Wick 2 and John Wick 3, if you've already changed the landscape, now you're given the task of upping yourself. And, you know, 8711 is one of the top stunt teams in the world as far as, you know, and as far as action design, they're just the time and the energy and the thought that they put into it. All those guys are very smart. They're very cerebral and they really understand filmmaking just as much as they understand stunt work. So when we were working on the third movie, it was really cool to see kind of the new ways they're going to innovate it, you know, what they're going to attempt. Obviously, that, you know, one of the first things I came to help out with was that the motorcycle chase. And we were just learning, how can you do this on a green screen, you know? And so I didn't end up being in the sequence on the day when they were doing it. They were actually shooting at the exact same time we were shooting the glass house fights upstairs. And then, but the process of building that together, that's such a laborious task. And it's also, it's an homage to The Villainous, which is like a really cool movie that had done a version of it. And then they were like, yeah, but what can we do to sort of like honor that and then take it a step further? And that's kind of the mantra that I feel like they work on a lot of the time. You know, there's only so many things you can do, but you are in charge of always innovating things and making it fresh. And really pushing the barrier. You know, that's why some of the biggest stunts, some of the biggest sequences have come out of that movie. You know, that's why that series is legendary at this point in time, you know. It's made Keanu like a meme again, which is amazing, you know, and he deserves it because he's one of the coolest guys. I found that out back in 2015 when I worked with him. He's such a chill, nice guy, you know, and he's got such a great sense of humor and he really does care about everybody else almost, you know, more than he cares about himself. You know, there was a part in John Wick 3, I remember, where like my timing was off, my positioning was off. Cause again, you're doing this thing where like, that's not a VFX, me coming out of the glass. I'm literally just hidden behind this very reflective set where you almost can't see. Like, once they turn the lights on, you're sort of blind. We actually would constantly run into glass walls all the time walking around that set. Like, hey, I got to go grab a cup of coffee, you know? And then you're like, all right, yeah, just be back in 5 minutes. Right. You go to turn around and smack, you run right into it. You're like, oh, wait, hang on. And you would see it. Everyone would come up to what they knew was part of a wall, and they carefully like put their hand forward to make sure it went through. And even then, once they knew that their hand was through it, they would gingerly step across the threshold as if they were expecting to run into a wall. Everyone at
one point, like one of those mirror mazes.
It's crazy. It's a gigantic infinity mirror in every direction. That's like that whole set. So then doing a fight sequence, you know, like there was a take where I was really off on my timing and stuff, and it just looked horrible. And, you know, they called it out. They're like, hey, do this, do that. You know, like, hey, just watch your timing. Your timing was off. And Keanu was like, no, it was me. It was me. Like, don't, you know, it was my bad. And I'm like, I don't know if he was bluffing or if he was just trying to cover for me or if he legitimately thought that something was his fault. I don't think it was. I think it was my fault. But, you know, the fact that he tried to make sure that, you know, no one was getting blamed falsely, you know, and that he had no problems like being the guy that, you know, was like, hey, it's my mess up. Yeah. Like he's just one of those very earnest, very open, you know, personalities, which I thought was really cool, you know, and I didn't even know if he'd remember me or not from the first time that we fought. And he, you know, we were getting into that, we did the first take of that first shot of the fight. And afterwards, we're already sweaty because it's, you know, it was just a lot of action for one take. And as he's going to check the monitors, he's all like, round two, huh, Mikey? And I was like, oh man, he remembers. Like, he remembers our first fight. So I was like, that's really cool, you know? And I don't know why he wouldn't have remembered it. It's just, you know, he's a big celebrity and I don't know what would have been memorable about me ever. So, but yeah, he's very, very cool and very, very, very polite. And, yeah, just a joy to work with, you know. Basically what I'm saying is everything you've heard about him is true. He's amazing.
Mm-hmm. What a guy. I actually wanted to ask you about the glass on set because it seemed like a practical effect. I suppose it was a practical effect after what you're saying. I was wondering what the reset time was like for that since you're getting thrown through glass like every other kick.
Yeah, like so it's funny because I take him the first part where I beat him out of the hallway and then there's no glass and then Akihiro just destroys every glass thing in there with him. And at the end of it, like, we pick him up, we kick him into like one last one. That was gnarly. So if I remember correctly, I think almost all of that glass is CGI. Like we had glass on the day that did explode and some of them did. And I think they did some reference passes, but I want to say that if I'm looking at the take that we used, I can sort of assume that I know what take we used because of the way that I'm moving and I kind of remember it. That one is mostly CGI, I want to say. And the glass like that has a huge reset time. I think that's why we moved more towards using VFX for a lot of things. It's because it's easier to do a safe reference pass and blow things and then use that to build into a set without the VFX or without the glass cases using the VFX. You know, it's the same way that we look at like squibs, right? If someone's getting shot and you have to have their shirt blow open and blood come out, you can spend a long time to sort of reset that and change their wardrobe between takes and everything, clean them off and then get them ready to go again, you know, or if it's going to be, you know, like a John Wick movie where there's a ton of those going off, if you just use VFX, it means you can just kind of shoot one. It didn't look right. Okay, move on. Like, let's do it again. Let's do, you know, go for another take. And that way you're saving tons of time. You know, you guys know time is the most valuable resource that you have when you're on set, you know, honestly. And like, if they're spending a lot of time resetting, then it's going to just destroy the movie, especially in a movie like that one where you have so much action.
With such a short time span. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely know that, for instance, like there's a scene where like John Valera, who's like one of the veteran stunt coordinator and stuntman himself, like, you know, he gets kicked through a glass. That's real. I know like a lot of that Jackson Spidell and Dan Hargrave, who are the stunt doubles for Keanu, they're going through a lot of real glass. Like that's craziness. They definitely did do real glass stuff. I just know that at some point there was a lot of VFX to help kind of blend or like add in something if there wasn't something that went perfectly on the day. But they didn't spend a lot of time resetting stuff just for the sake of trying to go. If it could be solved with VFX, they're smart enough filmmakers to know that they would just turn to that. You know, do we have enough to move on? Okay, we do. All right, then let's move on. Otherwise, you know, you're losing days. You're killing your schedule.
I just want to thank everyone for listening to this podcast episode with Michael Lear. This is just the part one of our interview with him. And part two, we'll be covering more of Extraction and his rocket jump experience. So stay tuned for that episode and I'll see everyone next week.